Panpsychism is the view that consciousness goes all the way down to the basic building blocks of reality. The consciousness of a sheep is simpler than the consciousness of a human being. Consciousness of a snail is simpler still. And as we move to simpler and simpler forms of life, we find simpler and simpler forms of conscious experience.
How can we conceptualize of a god that's of limited power and yet explains everything?
Traditional theism struggles with reconciling the terrible suffering we find in the world with an all-powerful, loving God.
Philip Goff, you don't believe in hell. So what happens when we die?
This is the Loaf Podcast. Today, we're interviewing Dr. Philip Goff, the man in large part responsible for the revival of panpsychism in Anglo-American philosophy, and somebody I've been reading for a long, long time. He's recently had a conversion to Christianity, which is in large part informed by this worldview. So we're really, really excited to get into that. So, Philip, usually we start by asking our guests when they've recently changed their mind in an important way. I think we may already have an idea of how you've changed your mind. I think a religious conversion is a pretty big one. So maybe you can just tell us in short about that change. Was it scary?
Wow. Yes. Where do I start with that in brief? I'm describing it as a heretical form of Christianity, just to kind of flag up it's maybe a little bit different from how people normally think about Christianity. I don't believe in the virgin birth. I think the Bible gets loads of stuff wrong. I don't believe God is all powerful, and I'm very uncertain whether it's all true. So it's maybe a little bit different, but yeah, I mean, it's only recently gone public with this, but I suppose it's been building up for a long time, a slow and gradual alteration that's happened in various stages that we might get to. But I guess for me, philosophy is not just kind of abstract questions. It's something I kind of live out. I can't live with myself if I don't know what I think about something, or if I change my mind, I have to follow it. And I've ended up in this rather odd place of this slightly heretical form of Christianity. But that's, you know, Bertrand Russell told us we have to follow the arguments where they lead. And this is where I've ended up. And it's made me a bit happier, actually. I wasn't unhappy before, but I think it's made me a bit happier.
Yeah, it tends to be the quite a common line from people who've just kind of converted to maybe more dogmatic forms of religion, you know. Makes me happy, community. But we'll get into that. We'll get into that in this maybe longer form interview, which we're really excited to do. I think maybe it's a bit of a background to you as well, and something to break the ice a little bit. And I think most importantly, as a kind of base to a discussion about panpsychism, maybe you could start us off by giving us your understanding and definition of consciousness and what you understand consciousness to mean. On a very basic level.
That's a very good place to start, because it is a little bit of an ambiguous word, actually. I think people use it in different ways. Some people use it to mean something like self-consciousness, awareness of one's own existence. But I think that's a bit more sophisticated to how it's standardly used in science and philosophy, where it's used just to mean experience of any kind. Your consciousness is just what it's like to be you at any given moment. So right now you're having an auditory experience of my voice speaking to you, visual experience of the room around you. If you pay a bit more attention, you'll notice tactile sensations of the chair beneath your body. So this is all part of what it's like to be you right now, your feelings, your experiences, and that's all we mean by consciousness, really. Some people say, oh, it's a mystery what consciousness is. I don't like that way of putting it. I think it's consciousness is the most evident thing. You know what pain is when you feel it. So I don't think it's a mystery so much what consciousness is. The real challenge is how it fits into our scientific understanding of the universe more generally.
I think an important clarification for our listeners before we get into the implications of what consciousness is and where it is kind of what we're doing here. So metaphysics is the discipline in philosophy which looks at what is the base nature of reality, right? What's the substratum that underlies everything? How do we explain the things that actually go on beneath the surface in science? And consciousness is really one of the central problems in metaphysics, right? And I think historically, and I know that you struggled with this as well, there's only really been two kind of solutions for a long time now. One of which is the dualism, which I think is implicit in a lot of religious belief, that consciousness is something entirely separate. So metaphysically, entirely separate from matter. And matter is what we look at in science. And that's taken a little bit less seriously nowadays by most people. And the alternative, I think, in the Anglo-American world is just strict materialism. Matter is all there is, and our minds and our consciousness is just built out of basically matter, and that's all there is to it. So what's missing for you in that materialist view specifically?
Yeah, I mean, just on dualism, I wouldn't say it's entirely dismissed. David Chalmers is probably one of the most influential living philosophers of consciousness, and he calls himself, he's somewhat sympathetic to my view of panpsychism, but he's also sympathetic to what he calls naturalistic dualism. Mm. And so he thinks consciousness is not physical. It's separate from the physical body and brain, but he wants to bring it into the scientific picture to find out through science, through neuroscience, laws that govern the interactions between the physical world and non-physical consciousness. But yeah, I mean, I guess it's not a view I'm incredibly sympathetic to. So what's wrong with the bog standard? You know, we've just got, actually, bog standard, I found out recently our American friends don't understand that word. I had some deep trouble on a podcast. An American host was saying, bug standard? The standard of bugs? What are you talking about? Anyway, vanilla, I think maybe is the closest translation for our American friends. Anyway, what is wrong with there's just the physical world, physics, chemistry, neuroscience, and consciousness kind of emerges from that? Well, you know, we've been trying for many decades now to make sense of that, to explain consciousness in terms of underlying processes in the brain. I would argue, you know, that decades-long project has got precisely nowhere, which is not to say the science of consciousness is not advanced. I would want to distinguish the science of consciousness from these more philosophical questions of whether we go for physicalism or dualism or panpsychism. So that philosophical project of trying to explain the emergence of consciousness in terms of underlying neurofacts about the brain, I don't think that's got anywhere. And I think there are good philosophical arguments that it's actually not really a coherent project. Whereas that what panpsychism proposes is to try and turn that explanatory project on its head. So rather than starting with physics and physical science and trying to get consciousness out of that, we turn it upside down. We instead start with consciousness and try and account for the emergence of physical reality from underlying facts about consciousness. And in stark contrast to the abject failure of physicalism, I think we've already worked out how to do this. Panpsychists have already worked out an adequate explanatory story of how that might happen. So I think we just need to contrast these two explanatory projects, trying to get consciousness out of the physical or trying to get the physical out of consciousness. One's gone nowhere, is arguably incoherent. The other, we've worked out how to do it. Feels a bit weird, but, you know, it's delivered the results. That's how I think about it.
Want your head and hair to feel cool and clean? Been going to extreme measures to cool your head off? Then get yourself a Manscaped. Don't be like Ollie and take your scalp from zero to hero with the new Scalp Buffer now. Use the discount code LOAF to get your 20% off.
Just to interrupt you there, sorry, Philip, thank you for that. Just, I think maybe for our viewers who might not be so familiar with panpsychism, maybe you could quickly elucidate your position, just briefly, and maybe from that, explain how panpsychism or your position solves the hard problem of consciousness. So in short, like what your main commitments are.
Yeah, that's a good point. I've jumped from physicalism to panpsychism, but yeah, I mean, that's a good, maybe initial way into it. Do we start, what comes first, chicken or the egg? You know, what comes, do we start with the physical world and consciousness pops out, or do we start with consciousness and the physical world pops out? A lot of people think of physicalism as, oh, that's the scientific story. But I would argue that actually, and we could get into this if you like, the scientific data is just neutral on all of these options. All of these options, for any scientific data, all of these different theories have a way of accommodating that data in their own terms. So I think we have to just explore these different options as philosophical options and see how they pan out. So that's the contrast, right? Do we start with physical stuff and consciousness pops out, or do we start with consciousness and physical reality pops out? So the panpsychist goes for that latter one. How on earth do we make sense of that? What, you know, listeners or viewers might be thinking, well, how can we get physics out of consciousness? What does that even mean? And here we draw inspiration from really important work from the 1920s by the philosopher and Nobel laureate Bertrand Russell. I think of Russell as the sort of Darwin of consciousness. I think he kind of solved all the mysteries here. And Russell's essential insight was that physics is just kind of mathematical, right? Physics is just a load of mathematical structure. Stephen Hawking famously said, physics doesn't tell us what breathes fire into the equations and makes a universe for them to describe. So Russell said, look, physics is just maths, right? And in that sense, physics doesn't really care what's at the base of reality. All it cares about is that it has the mathematical structure, right? Whatever's down there, as long as it has the right mathematical structure, you're going to be able to get physics out of that. That's all physics is. So contemporary panpsychists build on this and think, well, hold on, if we can tell some story about consciousness, some story about little, very simple conscious things interacting in simple, predictable ways, and through their interactions, they make certain patterns, certain mathematical structures. And if we can get the right mathematical structures out of that, we'll get physics. So this points us the way forward to get physics out of some underlying story about consciousness. For panpsychists, it's consciousness that breathes fire into the equations. So basically, I think we can't get consciousness out of physics, but we can get physics out of consciousness. Mm. We know that can be done, thanks to Professor Russell.
Thank you. Yeah. Incidentally, I actually agree with you that consciousness is what breathes fire into science. However, I think we could focus on exactly what's missing here. And I think looking at neuroscience might be a good example, right? People think, or some responses to panpsychism, right, have been, well, we haven't actually gotten that far in neuroscience. As we do more research, we may be able to work out effectively exactly what creates consciousness and at what parts in the brain. Now, you don't think that's the full story. And maybe we can dive into the like deep conceptual difference there, which really explains this difference between the behavior of matter that science looks at and actually what lies underneath and what lies underneath the creation of consciousness in our brain.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and one thing to point out that I've focused on in my book, Galileo's Error, for example, that's somewhere behind me. Shameless self-promotion is, you know, people have this idea, oh, you know, physical science is going amazingly. Of course it's going to explain consciousness. But if we take a slightly broader historical perspective, we find that actually physical science in an important sense kicks off with the father of modern science, Galileo, in the 17th century, taking consciousness out of science so that we can have a purely mathematical story, right? So Galileo had this idea. He wanted, for the first time in history, physics to be purely mathematical, science to be purely what he called natural philosophy. But the trouble was we get these qualities in experience, colors, sounds, smells, tastes that we can't capture in this purely quantitative mathematical vocabulary. So Galileo proposed a radical new philosophical worldview, right? He says, well, maybe all that consciousness stuff, that's outside of the physical world. That's outside of the scientific domain. Once we take that out, we can capture everything else mathematically. So the very project of physical science was premised on this separation of mathematical physics from qualitative consciousness. And I think, you know, if we want to bring these two things together, we're going to have to look at something like panpsychism for unifying the two together. But just to come, that was maybe a slight digression. Coming to your point is, you know, what is it? What's the principled reason to think this can't be done? That, you know, physical science doesn't have the resources to do this? Because look, when you think about what is, and I think Galileo understood this very well, what is physical science in the business of? It's in the business of tracking behavior. What stuff does the behavior of complex physical systems? You know, we take a complex, say, biological system and we postulate mechanisms to explain the observable behavior. Ultimately, we get to the laws of physics. It's all about observable behavior out there in the physical world. But when we're interested in explaining consciousness, it's a different explanatory project, right? We're not trying to explain some observable behavior out there. We're trying to explain our feelings and experiences that we're sort of immediately acquainted with, that we only know they exist because we're immediately aware of them. So it's just a very different explanatory project. So I think it's a little bit like saying, you know, telescopes are really good in astronomy. Maybe they'll be really good in pure mathematics as well. Well, no, it's just very different explanatory projects. And I think this is what Galileo realized at the start of the scientific revolution. We need to separate out these explanatory projects. And that went really well. That's gone really well. But I think people have forgotten these things were initially separated out. And they think, oh, it's going to explain everything. Well, no, these are just very different kind of things we're aiming to do. So yes, physical science has been amazing. It's been amazing at explaining observable behavior. But that's not what explaining consciousness is all about.
Okay.
That was a bit long-winded, sorry.
No, that was good. I want to make you go even further, because I think the way to do that is by taking it to an even simpler level, because I still think we're a little bit too advanced in the conversation. Let's push it back a little bit. Panpsychism, and correct me if I'm wrong, is very, very basically the view that what we view to be inert matter or unconscious matter, like atoms, has some basic form of proto-consciousness on a very basic level, and that coming together, that creates more complex forms of consciousness, from cockroaches to plants, or sort of rather from plants to cockroaches to humans. And I think maybe you could add to that a little bit, first of all, to kind of really flesh out what panpsychism is. And then maybe you could tell us why our current scientific view, or the view that most people hold, somehow is like has some form of cognitive dissonance to it. Why does the average person believe that the brain, that consciousness arises from the brain, and why is that so ingrained in kind of the general psyche, and how does panpsychism come into the picture?
Thanks, Lucas. You're an excellent host. You're bringing things down to brass tacks and the starting points I've skipped over. So panpsychism is the view that consciousness goes all the way down to the basic building blocks of reality. The way I like to talk about this is, you know, if you think about, you know, human consciousness is very complex, the result of millions of years of evolution. But consciousness comes in different shapes and sizes, right? There's the consciousness of a sheep is simpler than the consciousness of a human being. Consciousness of a snail is simpler still. And as we move to simpler and simpler forms of life, we find simpler and simpler forms of conscious experience. For the panpsychist, this keeps on going right down to the basic building blocks of matter, with electrons and quarks having incredibly simple forms of conscious experience to reflect their incredibly simple physical nature. And so, as you say, that from these very simple forms of experience we find at the level of fundamental physics, we build up in the human brain or the animal brain the incredibly complex form of experience we know and love. So then the question, what is the contrast with, I suppose, what is known as physicalism? Well, you said that consciousness comes from the brain. I mean, I don't deny that, right? I think, yeah, my consciousness is in my brain. That's, you know, it's not, I don't believe it's something magical in the soul outside of the brain. I think my feelings and experiences are just processes in my brain. It's just that I believe those processes are built up from simpler forms of consciousness at lower levels of physical complexity. So, yeah, so I think, like, I mean, there's undeniable stuff here that consciousness goes along with certain processes in the brain, right? That to my mind, that is the scientific task. The scientific task is working out which kinds of brain activity go along with consciousness. And that's something we've made progress on, although it's still a bit of a mess. We could talk about that. But that's not the full story, right? That's uncontroversial. Everybody agrees on that. That the philosophical question is, why? Why does brain activity of a certain kind go with consciousness? Why do consciousness and the physical world have anything to do with each other? And the scientific data just leaves that open. And so we turn to these philosophical possibilities. Well, maybe that's because consciousness is at the base of reality and physical world emerges from that.
Sorry, or could maybe, you just quickly maybe re-explain it's the other way around. There? Could you just quickly, just to hold you there for a second, why is it not possible that a human has consciousness only coming from kind of material atoms that themselves don't have consciousness, that they come together to form a more complex form that we call consciousness, rather? Why can that not be the case?
Well, I mean, that's the crucial question that is debated here. But I think there are two points here, right? If I could just distinguish them. The first point I was making just now was simply that the scientific data, any scientific data from neuroscience, is neutral on this question. So this is not, people think physicalism is the sort of scientific option. No, the scientific data is just neutral, right? Science tells us, and to be honest, common sense tells us to an extent, that brain activity and consciousness are correlated, right? They go together, and the science tries to establish more specifics. And there are different philosophical ways of explaining that. Physicalism, panpsychism, dualism. But I mean, all of these philosophical options are empirically equivalent, right? You can't do an experiment to tell us which is right. So then you might say, well, we should just be agnostic. My colleague, philosopher of science, Peter Vickers, said, well, yeah, we should just be agnostic. You can't do an experiment to work out which is right, so we should just be agnostic. That's one option. But then don't go and say, you know, you're a physicalist. Just say you don't know. You don't know whether physicalism or panpsychism or dualism are correct. But another option is to say, okay, the experiments can't decide it, but we can try and evaluate these theories in other ways. Do philosophy, right? And we can look at how well they, for example, explain what they're supposed to explain. So physicalists have been trying to explain consciousness, panpsychists are trying to do it the other way around. And we just look at the, see how well they've done. And I would say panpsychism has done much better than physicalism, right? And so that is the preferred, that ought to be the preferred option. It, and I think it's just kind of for cultural reasons, it feels a bit weird that, you know, it's still a fairly minority view, although it's taken much more seriously than it was 10 years ago.
I'm going to move it to a bit of a speculative question, but before I do that, just to close up on maybe giving a bit of my personal journey with panpsychism, the bit that really clinched it for me in terms of understanding that distinction, which I watched your interview with Joe Rogan a long, long time ago. And I think there was a while in the interview where he was really struggling to get that difference between the correlation of the brain to the experience. So the bit that really clinched it for me at one point was the emergence problem, right? Which is that consciousness, right? If we assume that it isn't in fundamental particles, must come at some point as the system gets more complex. And I don't think there's any point where you can say you have, you know, a system which is X amount of complex, right? And then you come in and you have a system which is X plus 0.001 more complex, and all of a sudden consciousness is there. That seems inexplicable to me. So I'll close off with that, but I'd like to ask you maybe about the implications of panpsychism for how we're looking at AI nowadays, right? Because if consciousness is already there, and it's the emergence from these integrated systems, from these complex systems, there's two options. Either explain why AI isn't conscious, or bite the bullet and accept something that I think a lot of people would struggle to accept, which is that, yeah, AI either is or very soon can be conscious, so insofar as that system gets complex enough. So I'm wondering how you look at that.
Important questions. It's not straightforward. You know, I think David Chalmers, who I mentioned earlier, who's more sympathetic to me on the philosophy, but would maybe have very different answers to those questions on AI. But I mean, I suppose the way I think about it is, if you are a physicalist, and you're probably more inclined to the view that being conscious is just a matter of information processing, complex processing of information in the brain. And so you're going to be more inclined to an openness to AI. AI could be AI, something like we've got now could be conscious if we just get the right kind of information processing. Whereas panpsychists, we don't think that consciousness is magical, but we think it's sort of the stuff of the world. It's not about organization and functioning. It's the flesh and blood of the world. And so I think artificial consciousness because consciousness is not magical, it's going to be possible to make artificial consciousness, but I think we should be looking at something more like an artificial living system, you know, maybe something like a, you know, bacterium in the first instance. And then maybe in 5,000 years, we get something like a human being or something. And I was at an AI summit recently with people, you know, made ChatGPT and stuff. And we were going around the table and saying, when are we going to get general AI? And they were all saying 100 years, 50 years. And I said 5,000 years. And, yeah, so maybe slightly different perspectives there. But although I was going to talk about artificial consciousness rather than artificial AI, I mean, I suppose that's another point of how we understand the relationship between intelligence and consciousness. Do those two things have to go together or not? That's another complexity here.
Thank you, Philip, first of all, for the introduction to panpsychism. I think if our listeners want to learn more about panpsychism, they can definitely read your books. I think maybe specifically Galileo's Era is a good place to start. We're going to move the conversation on a little bit because, as we mentioned, maybe at the beginning of this interview, you've recently had a bit of a shift to Christianity, right? We're going to get to that, but first we're going to take take a slight step back to maybe the middle ground between panpsychism and Christianity, panentheism. I think this is a really interesting one. And just for those listening who might not be familiar with the word panentheism, but maybe more pantheism, it's kind of a riff of pantheism. It's basically the view that in some sense, the world is inside God or inside some theistic higher power. Basically both that everything is God, but that also there is some divide between creator and created. First off, can you maybe explain your understanding of panentheism?
Thanks, Lucas. Something close to that, I think. So pantheism is the view that that God is the universe. The universe and God are one and the same thing. Whereas panentheism is the view that the universe is in some sense inside God. So there's more to God than just the physical universe, but the physical universe isn't something completely separate to God. Rather, it's part of the being of God, right? So the physical, so the universe is part of God. That's the basic way I would understand it. Should I say a bit more about the motivation, or what do you?
I'll quickly come in here because I find this topic really interesting, especially as someone who's just graduated with English literature. I don't know if you know Simon Critchley.
I know the name. Go on, tell me about Simon.
Yeah,
Critchley.
No, he's a brilliant philosopher. 21st century philosopher, and when we interviewed him, we really discussed the link between literature and philosophy. And I think it's just maybe it's a bit of an aside and maybe more of a foundational point, but during my final year at Oxford, I did quite a bit of work with like Coleridge and Wordsworth. And I think in terms of panentheism, there's just a couple of quotes that I'll read out that I think are relevant. In Tintern Abbey, Wordsworth writes about a hermit by his fire. And he writes about a hermit who is materially alone, but not spiritually alone. And there's this idea that even within this panentheistic view, within the fire itself, maybe there are some forms of consciousness in nature as well. So I'm sensing already some kind of link here between panentheism and panpsychism, which I think is really cool. There's The Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Coleridge, which also seems to link. Coleridge believed in multeity, in unity, in a theological sense. And in The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, he writes, or the mariner says rather, I looked upon the rotting sea, I looked upon the rotting deck, I looked to heaven. Again, there's this sense that heaven and the rotting deck are kind of syntactically placed in the same level. Even kind of the rotting deck has a certain life to it, a certain consciousness maybe. So I feel that maybe the clinching point here in terms of discussing literature is, again, a contemporary to all these writers, Mary Shelley, who writes Frankenstein. And I think that's almost, at least metaphorically speaking, one of the most interesting ways where we see Victor Frankenstein create a monster who is conscious, created from what we believe to be unconscious matter. So there's lots of interesting points here. I was wondering what your thoughts are, maybe firstly about panentheism, and maybe more broadly about literature and its connection to philosophy.
Yeah, fascinating. That's really fascinating. I've had two or three discussions now with the novelist Philip Pullman, who wrote the His Dark Materials trilogy, that was a BBC HBO thing recently, and we got in touch because he's fascinated and inspired by panpsychism.
I saw he reviewed your book, right?
Well, he's done the blurb for my last two books. Yeah, I'm not sure how he's going to feel about the change to heretical Christianity. He's not that keen on religion, but anyway,
not very.
see how that goes. So if you'll want to blurb the next book anyway. But he also, part of his attraction to panpsychism is those same poets. Tintin Abbey, he quoted at one of our discussions the line, something more deeply interfused. So this sense that there is a higher form of consciousness, not out there in some supernatural realm beyond the universe, but somehow pervading the universe we inhabit. In the psychological test, tick box test to see if someone's had a mystical experience, one of the boxes to tick is, do you have a sense of a living presence in all things? So we can talk about the intellectual motivations, but certainly this conception of the divine, I find, spiritually resonates with me, at least in a deeper way than, I guess, the more supernaturalist conception of God I kind of imbibed in my Catholic upbringing that I rejected when I was 14 and refused to get confirmed and upset my grandmother. So certainly in line with what you mentioned of these poets, I think it does somehow, with me at least, deeply spiritually resonate. Doesn't mean it's true, of course.
I think there's always that element in philosophy. As much as the arguments go back and forth, ultimately something has to click, right? And you then have to substantiate that position. But having that click, which you weren't able to account for before, in terms of the actual argumentation for your move from panpsychism to panentheism, or for those who maybe don't quite buy panpsychism yet, you feel that there's a need for something to explain certain aspects of the universe. I want to talk about kind of the two main points you mentioned, right? Which is the fine tuning of the universe for life. Let's start with, before we move on to psychophysical harmony. Why does the fine tuning of the universe convince you that there must be something there, right? Because I guess the skeptical argument would be a tiny chance over a long enough time period and something will occur.
So just to give people a sense of where I'm coming from, I always end up being the middle way option. I think, you know, so many people think we have to choose between the God of traditional religion or meaningless, purposeless universe, right? And I came to find both of these traditional views, in my view, have deep challenges, have things they can't explain. Traditional theism struggles with reconciling the terrible suffering we find in the world with an all-powerful, loving God. Why would an all-loving God choose to create us with such a horrific process like natural selection? So there are things traditional supernaturalist all-powerful God hypothesis struggles to explain, like suffering. But I think there are also things atheism struggles to explain. So the one you mentioned, Oliver, the fine-tuning of physics for life, this surprising discovery of recent decades that certain numbers in physics, at least our current physics, are like Goldilocks porridge, exactly as they need to be for life to be a possibility. And these are the numbers that have governed our universe from the first moments after the Big Bang, right? So just to take an example, dark energy, which powers the accelerating expansion of the universe, according to our current best theories, if that force had been slightly stronger, everything would have shot apart so quickly, no two particles would have ever met. We wouldn't have had stars, planets, any kind of structural complexity at all, and therefore no life, one would think. Whereas if it had been significantly weaker, everything would have collapsed back on itself split second after the Big Bang. So for life to be possible, that force had to be in a very, very narrow range. On the face of it, it looks incredibly improbable that you would get something in that very narrow range just by chance, right? So, I mean, I think in our normal standard ways of thinking about evidence, this is evidence for some kind of goal-directedness towards life in the very, very early universe. And to be honest, I think we are ignoring it for cultural reasons. I think it's like when we first had evidence that we're not in the center of the universe and people couldn't handle it because it didn't fit with the picture of reality they got used to. And now we laugh at those people and think, why didn't they just follow the evidence? But I think every generation absorbs a worldview it can't see beyond. I think future historians looking back at us will just think, why did everyone just ignore this evidence of fine tuning that is so straightforwardly evidence for some sort of goal-directedness? So, yeah, I mean, obviously, there's lots of debatable points here, but the fact that it is so not taken seriously, even though it's fairly uncontroversial scientific data, I think is noteworthy.
Mm-hmm. And how would you respond to an argument which uses the monkey and the typewriter as an analogy that perhaps we're not sure exactly how entropy works, right? The universe might be collapsing, coming back out, and so on. And at one point in all of those, we may have just come out with a universe that came out with the right measurements, as unlikely as those are. I think the statistics you use in your book was if you roll a dice 70 times and it comes out in the same number every time, that's 1 in 10 to the 55 or something. And the chance of whichever measurement it was being correct was something like 1 in 10 to the 170, right? Which seems so unlikely. But how would you respond to the argument that, look, we just don't know. There's a decent chance at least as well that over time through a repeated process, we just got there.
Yeah. I mean, I used to think that, adopt that hypothesis myself for a long time. I always thought this needed explaining. It can't just be fluke. We could go into the fluke possibility if you like, but yeah, many, many philosophers and physicists try to give a multiverse explanation, right? So if you've got enough monkeys on typewriters, one of them's going to flukily write some meaningful English. But it's just when I started teaching this, actually, I became persuaded by philosophers of probability, and there's been a literature in the academic journals on this for decades now. I find it bizarre. It's just a typical example of academics talking to themselves that nobody knows about this outside of academic philosophy. So that, I mean, this is what led to this book, Why, modestly titled Why the Purpose of the Universe, was, you know, I just became persuaded there's really dodgy reasoning going on in trying to explain fine-tuning in terms of a multiverse. So, I mean, just let's stick with the monkeys on typewriters example. You know, suppose you're walking around in the jungle and you see a monkey typing perfect English, you know? You'd say, so something needs explaining here. You know, maybe it's a robot, maybe it's specially trained, maybe it's someone dressed up. What you wouldn't say is, well, maybe there are lots of other planets with monkeys on typewriters and most of them are typing rubbish and this is the one that's typing good stuff, right? You wouldn't say that because, you know, your evidence is this particular monkey. What you need explained is this particular monkey in front of you, right? And postulating monkeys elsewhere doesn't help explain that. Now, there's a crucial difference you might be about to say. There's a crucial difference in the fine-tuning case. Well, we couldn't have observed, right? This is called sort of anthropic principle. We couldn't have observed a universe that wasn't fine-tuned. We could have observed a monkey that wasn't typing perfect English. Well, we could just modify the case, right? Suppose there's a sniper hiding in a tree waiting to shoot you dead if the monkey doesn't type perfect English, right? That still wouldn't justify postulating monkeys on typewriters in other worlds, right? Still, it doesn't change anything. We need an explanation of this monkey in front of us. So that's a way into it. This gets into kind of principles of probabilistic reasoning, which is ultimately what persuaded me here. But that's a way into why I don't buy the multiverse explanation. I've got more and more working with some interesting stuff going to be coming out. Actually, more and more I'm collaborating with physicists looking into the, you know, the credentials of the multiverse hypothesis in more detail. But that's the motivation, the worry with me from just philosophy of probability.
No, that's really interesting. And something I found interesting as well was you mentioned why. Reading why, I could see you retrospectively, having seen your switch to a heretical form of Christianity, how you were maybe leading there. But you made a criticism of your current own view. So I was wondering how you would respond to it. And often one of the reasons for postulating God in philosophy of religion is that it's an ultimate explanation, some kind of necessary being that postulates or that ontologically supports everything contingent in the world, right? And that's because it's necessary because it's all powerful, all knowing, and all good. Now, you say that we should have a God of limited power so we can understand the problem of evil, that maybe God wasn't able to stop this. Can God, or can a God of limited power, explain the existence of the universe? Or is this something which you're agnostic on, or which is maybe lacking from the more general picture you have?
So that is the view I've ended up with. The best hypothesis here is a God of limited ability, a God who's not all powerful. So I think the all powerful God hypothesis can't explain the terrible suffering we find looking at our TV screens every day. But traditional atheism can't explain fine tuning and certain other things to do with consciousness that are a bit trickier to explain. But I think that the God of limited powers hypothesis, I think, can explain all the data, right? So we can explain the fine tuning in terms of God's purposes for the universe, God wanting a universe compatible with the possibility of life. We can explain the suffering we find in terms of God's limitations. So that the hypothesis would be that God simply can't create intelligent life, complex intelligent life, by clicking God's fingers. If God has fingers. The only way God can create intelligent life is by creating a universe with the right kind of physics that will eventually evolve it. And God's like, I know it's going to be messy. It's going to be horrible. I'm sorry. It was this or nothing. It was the best I could do, guys. So yeah, I think that's the, I think it's really, that is to my mind, the hypothesis that is where the evidence is pointing as we currently have it. Sounds a bit weird. Again, it sounds a bit weird, but it does the job, I think.
Yeah, I have a question or perhaps criticism about your solution to the problem of evil with the God of limited power. I'm not sure it 100% deals with the issue. But just before we get onto that, I just want to stick on the point of God serving as the explanatory or ontological foundation of the universe. Now, a God of limited power doesn't seem to quite fit this picture of a necessary being which sits under everything in the same way, right? You would expect that something which is the ontological substratum of the universe, right, would be ultimately powerful. How can we make sense of a God with limited power? How can we conceptualize of a God that's of limited power and yet explains everything, right? There must be something that sits under it or something along those lines, right?
Yeah, it's a good question. The distinguished Christian philosopher Richard Swinburne, as we had a debate on the Unbelievable YouTube channel, he's pressing something like these concerns to me. I would say God is still a necessary being, is still the ultimate foundation of everything that is and was and will be. So why can't a necessary being have limited power? I mean, I'm not thinking there's something outside of God that's limiting God. It's just God is the ultimate. It's just that, as Wittgenstein says, explanations have to stop somewhere. You've got to stop somewhere with your fundamental story of reality. In my mind, that would just be the fundamental fact that God is limited in what God is able to do. I mean, maybe the all-powerful God hypothesis is a little bit simpler, and so there's a little bit less of a why question there, maybe. But you never entirely get rid of the why question. You know, even with the all-powerful traditional God, you've still got the question, well, why? Why does it exist? Why isn't there nothing? Well, you know, so you've always got to take something as brute as the foundation. So I don't see why I can't take a God who's not all powerful as the foundation.
Yeah, it's true. I guess I do ultimately agree that when I was younger, and I was doing philosophy of religion for the first time, I found the necessary existence thing, maybe a little unsatisfying as an ultimate explanation, which I think is what I was looking for at the time, right? The idea that there'll be a point where we go, oh, okay, that's it, right? But obviously, there's got to be some explanatory bedrock. But to move it to the problem of evil, if that's all right with you in specific, your essential criticism of the all-powerful, all-knowing, all-loving God is that they could have created a universe where we didn't need to go through this messy process with immense amounts of suffering in order to get the kind of complex consciousness and connection with God that we have today. And so therefore, the kind of value of free will and so on and so forth doesn't really counterbalance all the suffering that we have, all the natural suffering and so on. However, for me, there's still a problem in that the God of limited power, assuming that that God, you know, had a decent foreknowledge of what was going to come about and how this process was going to go, right, still knew the kinds of suffering, the genocides throughout history and currently, the immense animalistic suffering on an everyday scale, murder, etc., and so on, and still chose to put people through that simply so we could come closer to God in some way or feel united to God in some way. I don't know if from the perspective of the person who's suffering immensely, starving, has experienced sexual assault, has been murdered, has had a child killed, that this connection with a being justifies all that.
Yeah, very nicely put. These are very challenging questions. I suppose I would say there is an important moral difference between a God who's made this universe but could have made intelligent life without all the pain of natural selection, let's say, could have made intelligent life without hurricanes and natural disasters, and a God who, you know, that was their only option. It was this or no intelligent life, right? And I suppose with the latter question, thinking of the God I believe in of limited power, you know, I think, yes, life is horrible. There's all sorts of suffering. But still, I think a case can be made that it's still on balance better that we have life than that we don't. I think that sounds quite plausible to me. It's not totally sure of that, but it's still, it's if you had the choice, you know, I mean, we can ask the question, because we have, I've gotten the word. We have antinatalists who think, you know, it's not worth it and it's immoral to have children. We should let the human race die out. But I think most of us would think, you know, if you're going to choose between total annihilation and letting things carry on as they are, the latter is better. So I think it sounds plausible to me that the God of limited powers was making the good choice. If that was their only option, if it was life or no life, if it was life as we have it or no life, then it was the right moral choice to go for life. Whereas a God who could get life with much less pain, I find it much harder to make sense of that as a sensible, correct moral choice.
Okay, to maybe move it on now to your Christianity specifically, Philip. I'm curious why Christianity, because just based off my own understanding of my experience with speaking with Christians, Protestants, Catholics, it's interesting that you marry a God that is limited with a religion that fundamentally believes in God as the highest all-powerful being, a God that can do basically anything. I'm again, I'm curious why Christianity and what motivated you to go for that religion rather than, it almost makes more sense to me for you to have started your own religion.
That's something I'm not going to do. Yeah, I don't like power enough. I like people disagreeing with me so too much. Not entirely without ego, but not really much of a craving for power. Anyway, I don't think I'd be a very good cult leader. For a long time, I thought Christianity wasn't an option because I thought, you know, it was an all-powerful God. And because I thought, like I think many people think, that the core of Christianity involves this idea that's known as penal substitution, that it's all about Jesus paying the price for our sins. So, you know, we're all sinners. We deserve to burn in hell forever. But Jesus kindly took the flak for us, took the punishment for us, and now we can go to heaven. And I mean, I've got respect for friends and colleagues who defend that view, but personally, I find that one of the most implausible philosophical or theological views ever defended. I mean, we could talk about that if you like. So I just thought that was Christianity. So I thought, you know, there's no way I'm a Christian because I just find that too implausible. But actually, it's just from wide reading and many conversations with many different kinds of Christian thinkers that I actually found that that's not even the official view, right? That's one theory of the mechanics of Christian salvation associated with the Protestant Reformation, really, but something similar was defended by Anselm in the 11th century. But actually, there are many, many different, even with very traditional non-heretical Christianity, many ways of understanding what it's all about. And in particular, what I became attracted to is the way of understanding that's found more in the Eastern Church, the Eastern Orthodox Church, where there's much more of a focus on it being about God and us and the universe coming together into a state of deep intimacy. So there's less of a focus on sin in the Eastern Church. There's more of a focus on what the Jesus stuff was all about, was God and the universe coming into an intimate connection. Perhaps what there's this bit where in the Gospels where Jesus is talking about this metaphor of the vine and the branches, right? If you think, you know, the vine and the branches, there's a deep, intimate, organic connection between a vine and its branches. So for the Eastern Orthodox Church, the point, that's the ultimate goal of creation, is for God and the universe to come into this deep, intimate, organic connection, like the connection between a vine and its branches. But the thought is there's a problem, right? And the problem is we're a bit different to God, right? Don't know about you two, but I am anyway.
Speak for yourself. You know, yeah.
God's, you know, timeless, immaterial, ultimate source of all of existence, whereas we're just kind of temporal, embodied, contingent beings. So they're kind of too different. They're not like the vine and the branch. They're too different to come into this intimate unity. So then the thought is, well, the solution was God becoming a bit more similar to us, right? God taking on a physical nature, sharing in our form of existence so that we can share in God's form of existence, and that this somehow closes the gap between God and creation. So this is not normally defended with a God of limited powers, although there are forms of Christianity that go for a God of limited powers. But it just struck me at some point in conversations with people who like this view that I think it fits really well with a God of limited powers. So just to finish off, I guess my conception of Christianity is there's a God who wants to create a perfect universe, but the only way they're able to do it is to create, to sort of do it in two stages, to start, first create a kind of okay universe with the right physics that's going to evolve life in that messy process. And then in the second stage, as life becomes evolved enough, God begins to bring the universe to perfection by becoming more intimately involved with it, closing the gap between God and creation. A long-winded process that's perhaps still in motion, long way to go. But I suppose it struck me that this particular form of Christianity fits quite well with a God of limited powers, which is what I think is a very well supported hypothesis. So it was that clash that first got me thinking of it. But just very, very finally, I just want to add, I'm very uncertain whether it's true, right? I've just made a kind of bold argument for a God of limited powers. I really think there's a good case for that. But as for Christianity, I'm much less certain. I suppose I've come to think it's a credible possibility because I think it fits well with the God of limited powers, which I think is well supported. So I'm very, very far from certain. I think it could be true. It could be false, but I also think faith is not about certainty. I think faith is about trust more than belief. It's about trusting a certain view of the meaning of existence, trusting it to shape your fundamental life goals and guide you in how you interpret your fundamental experiences. It's more a sort of living in hope of something rather than certainty. And yeah, that's where I've ended up. That was my most long-winded answer yet. I'm sorry for that, but go for it.
Thank you.
The detail is necessary, you know, to get there. But I think that's why we tried to conduct the interview in a series of steps, right? To build an overall picture of where you're at. And I think at each stage, it doesn't seem so large a jump. And then somebody might end up at a worldview, which is by the end of this interview, quite different from theirs. But I want to hone in on the move from panentheism to, although you're not fully certain and there's a faith element, to Christianity specifically. And whilst it's a coherent story, and I think, you know, the story of bringing God closer is definitely more compelling than penal substitution, which I struggled with when I was a kid as well. Why should someone believe that this is what Jesus was doing, right? In some kind of evidential sense, why should we prioritize the story of Jesus over some, you know, some other story, some other panentheistic story?
Right. So the question is not whether this is the correct interpretation of Christianity. It's more like why Christianity rather than some other religion. I mean, one thing is, as I just said, I don't think faith is about certainty. And I think once you accept that, then it opens up the possibility of religious pluralism, right? So if you think faith has to be about certainty, then to have faith, you've got to be certain your religion's true and then the others are false. But I think actually, really all that's required for faith is that it's a credible possibility. That's enough, I think, to live in hope, to take that leap of faith, maybe that it's kind of 30% possibility. And it could be that there's more than one religion that is a credible possibility. That's something I'm not ruling out. But I suppose why Christianity? I mean, it does, in my view, fit with this view that I do believe the God of limited powers, that I think is well evidenced. And you know, once you're on board with that, I suppose that opens you up to other reasons to take it seriously. I mean, one thing, Jesus just being an absolutely incredible thinker and teacher, not necessarily say the best in the whole of history, but certainly a very rare and extraordinary teacher. Now, just in itself, that doesn't tell us anything, but I think in the mix, it counts for something. I also think that there is something a little bit hard to explain about the origins of Christianity. I think there's good historical evidence that soon after Jesus died, lots of people, including one person who was a violent opponent of the movement, had these experiences that persuaded them that he was alive again in some sense. And it looks like they were pretty powerful experiences because they motivated them to vigorously defend this conviction for many, many decades against violent opposition. So again, this is, I mean, even skeptical New Testament historians like Bart Ehrman would agree with that much, right? I mean, again, this is not on its own. This doesn't prove anything, right? I think if you're starting from an atheist position, you should just say, okay, Jesus was a great teacher. That doesn't mean anything. Okay, maybe there was a bit of a weird form of mass hallucination after Jesus died. Maybe some people had grief hallucinations, and then there was a bit of groupthink hysteria or something. You know, I think that's a fine explanation, because I think Carl Sagan was right that extraordinary proposals require extraordinary evidence, right? And if you're starting from an atheist perspective, the Christian story is so implausible that the evidence I've just talked about is really nowhere near enough. But what is an extraordinary hypothesis depends on your worldview. So if you're approaching the evidence like me, with this God of limited powers hypothesis, and you think this form of Christianity fits well with that, so it's already a credible possibility, and then you're thinking about explanations of these slightly weird origins of Christianity and fitting in what an extraordinary character Jesus was. And so from that perspective, it all starts to get a bit more plausibility. But to repeat again, this still doesn't get me very far, but maybe at most 50-50, you know, it's still, I wouldn't be surprised if it was true. I wouldn't be surprised if it was false. So, yeah, but that's, I guess that's something like where I'm up to.
Yeah. Just cause, and I apologize to again, push back, and, we'll move it on in a moment, but I want to press the point just a little bit more, cause that's what Ollie and I at least, try and do here, is try and really get to not only some form of truth, but also why our guests kind of think that other people should adopt their views. So I guess my question will have two parts. First of all, whether you believe in lots of the biblical miracles like Jesus's resurrection and some other things like that, because I think that's firstly like really core parts of Christianity that if you don't believe might be hard to kind of justify why you still call yourself a Christian. And then I think maybe the next part of that is maybe from a more personal point of view, why so much of your writing and your thinking feels very, very grounded in logical step-by-step movements up. And I don't mean this in any sort of like rude way. It's more just I'm curious why you don't just stick with a more agnostic view of religion, and why you do feel that move to Christianity. I'm curious if it's maybe more of a psychological move towards Christianity than one grounded in philosophy.
Thanks, Lucas. Certainly don't apologize for raising these points. This is what it's all about. This is great. The resurrection was a big stumbling block for me in taking this seriously. So I suppose I found out about this Eastern Orthodox way of thinking about Christianity, of God and the universe coming together, that making a lot of sense to me.
Sure.
But yeah, the resurrection was always, hold on, this is no good. And I think part of it is I worry it brings back to the problem of evil. So remember, my solution to the problem of evil and suffering is that God can't deal with it, right? But if God can raise people from the dead, then we're back to the problem. Why don't you do that more often, right? There's a lot of terrible suffering from grief in the world, a lot of lives cut short. So that was something that stopped me for a long time. The final piece in the jigsaw was reading the book by a wonderful book on the resurrection by liberal biblical scholar Dale Allison. I really like Dale Allison. He's incredibly, so many people in this area, whether they're on the Christian side or the atheist side, are sort of like defense lawyers, you know, defending their position. And his book, he's very uncertain and raises the best options on both sides, and a wonderful thinker, I think. Anyway, he has a a slightly unorthodox view of the resurrection. I don't know how much detail we want to go into this, but partly it's a visionary conception of the resurrection, right? So he doesn't think this was a matter of seeing and touching a body, right? Like, rather these were visionary experiences more akin to what we find described in the New Testament in Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus, right? He's sort of thrown to the ground, having this crazy visionary experience. So in the Allison picture of things, what we should be thinking of on the first Easter Sunday is lots of the early Christians start getting thrown to the ground and having these wild experiences, and it's just getting more and more pronounced to more and more people. So it becomes apparent there's something weird going on here, even if it's not actually seeing and touching a body. So, well, I could go into more details about that, but that was an important part of the making sense of its story to me. So on your point, yeah, it's interesting. Why don't I just stay agnostic? Well, I mean, in a way, intellectually, I am agnostic. I said my confidence in the truth of Christianity is at best 50-50. Mm-hmm. So intellectually, I am agnostic. But 50-50 is, I mean, it's still quite high, you know, for such an incredible theory of reality. So I suppose, I mean, I've been led there by thinking it's a good fit with this, to my mind, well-evidenced theory of reality, namely the God of limited powers hypothesis. So that makes me think this is something that could be true, that there's a really non-negligible chance that it's true. But yeah, but I, in a sense, I am agnostic. And then I think faith is about a decision to choose to live in trust of that. You know, like you decide to trust someone, right? You might not have enough evidence let me take another example. Do we have enough evidence that we're going to deal with climate change? I think, God, we can't be too confident. Maybe we can't even be 50-50. But it's reasonable, I think, to have faith that we're going to deal with climate change, right? To root for it, to, if that gives you meaning and motivation to say, I'm going to choose to have faith that we're going to do this. So likewise, that's how I think about religion, that you should be thinking, yeah, you want it to be a credible possibility. I think there are some religions that are too implausible to even have faith in. But I think you should be thinking, is this a credible possibility? And is trusting in it going to give me meaning and motivation and hope in my life? And I've found that it does that for me. And I'm quite aware that it's very uncertain and it might not be true. And, you know, if I live my life, it's not true, no worries. I've had community and spiritual practice and a sense of meaning and purpose. I found it's lessened my ego quite a lot. So I think in thinking about religion, I think people think, oh, is this certain? Is it certain that this is true? No, it's not certain. So that's it. That's the end of it. But I think we should be thinking both about the evidence, is it a credible possibility, but also could this give me meaning and fulfillment? So two things together, I think.
Thank you. Philip Goff, you don't believe in hell. So what happens when we die?
So I think if you're starting from an atheistic position, then you should be very, very confident there's no life after death, right? If you're starting from a belief in a loving, all-powerful God, then I think you should probably be confident there is life after death, right? Because there's a loving God who can do anything. I'm in the middle, right? I believe in a good God of limited powers, right? So I think it's plausible God would want to preserve our consciousness after death, right? The thing we don't know is whether God's able to do that, right? Maybe God can, maybe God can't. And so I think that leaves it at the level of again, a credible possibility, maybe a rational hope, but certainly far from certain. And the Christian story, as I understand it, is that, you know, God did find a way of doing that through this process of bringing God and the universe closer together. So to the extent that I live my life in trust of that uncertain possibility, I live in trust that there is some form of existence, life after death. But again, I'm very uncertain. I'm very, very open to the possibility that there's nothing after death. I mean, just finally, you said about hell. I definitely don't believe in hell. But actually, most liberal Christians tend to be what's called universalists, that, you know, we're all going to go to heaven. Again, the tricky thing to me is, for me is, again, because God has limited ability, I think God would want to save everyone. But because God is not all powerful, I don't know, maybe God can't save everyone. Maybe you've got to be kind of up for it a bit. I don't know. So I suppose I'm sort of agnostic between a universalist position. Well, I'm agnostic about it all, as I hope I've made clear. But insofar as I'm thinking of Christianity, I would be uncertain about whether universalism or what's called annihilationism, that, you know, some people get some life after death and some people, it's just the end, right? That's one Christian theory of life after death. And the reason I'm open to that is because I don't know what God's able to do.
Yeah, thank you. Just as we wrap up the conversation of Christianity, I want to emphasize, whilst I'm not necessarily convinced, I think it's in terms of internal coherence and straightforward thinking, you know, which I think it's a problem with organized religion, right? Often that we accept dogmas from the generation before. And I think it's good to go a bit deeper. I think, definitely your account of Christianity, the way you fit limited power into the story of Jesus and everything is very convincing as far as stories of Christianity go. So I just want to emphasize that point, that I think it really seems like you've thought about every aspect. And that's something which, without overgeneralizing, sometimes doesn't happen when people come to religious faith.
Thank you. I think, yeah, there's been a lot of responses to it, actually, both from traditional Christians and from atheists. My favorite atheist response was an article that says, "I'm still an atheist, but Philip Goff's version of Christianity sounds lovely." So I was quite happy with that one.
Yeah, that's good as far as it goes, especially in philosophy of religion, which can get pretty heated at times, especially when it's between two friends. But I just wanted to ask you about, kind of from a personal perspective rather than a philosophical perspective, how you feel about your conversion to Christianity perhaps impacting the reception of your panpsychism and of your other philosophical views. I know that that comes with a lot of baggage. And when I was first learning about panpsychism at 16, I think I was much stronger on the atheist side than I am now. And it might have, although I couldn't say, it might have maybe moved me away from it and made me think, oh, this isn't serious science, as that bias goes. So I guess, how do you feel about that? What do you think? And how do you think that will impact reception of panpsychism and all your other philosophical views?
It's a good question. I mean, I do want to emphasize, especially given what we've been talking about, that there's no necessary connection with panpsychism and anything spiritual.
Definitely.
There's a bit of a divide in the contemporary panpsychist research community, maybe a bit like the divide between in the early psychoanalytic community between followers of Jung and followers of Freud. Followers of Jung were into sort of spiritual archetypes and the collective unconscious and taking things in a spiritual direction, whereas Freud was like, this is all superstitious nonsense, this needs to be serious science. And there's very much a similar split. So there's people like David Chalmers, who's sympathetic to panpsychism, if not fully subscribing, Luke Roloff's, Angela Mendelovici, who are very reductionist, secular. Angela Mendelovici is a moral nihilist, thinks there are no facts about value. Oh, I laughed. Very, very, you know, compatibilist about free will, whatever. Very, you know, they don't believe in any transcendent reality. They just think, they believe in ordinary consciousness, seeing red, hearing sound, and think we need to modify our scientific story of the world to accommodate it. Whereas other people, I guess I'm a bit more on this side, as you might have guessed, see a certain consonance with a panpsychist view, with certain spiritual convictions, maybe like panentheism, maybe like taking mystical experiences seriously. But that's another step, you know, and you'd need more motivations for that, maybe like the fine tuning that's got me going and so on. But it is a serious worry, and many people on the non-religious side of panpsychism, many close friends, I won't mention any names, have been a bit worried about this, to be honest, and a little bit not, I mean, very supportive of my choices, and I've got to follow my heart, but you know, not entirely thinking it's ideal that I as maybe one of the prominent proponents of panpsychism have become religious, and everyone's going, oh, it's just religion. And I can see that. I can see the worry, but I don't know. Look, I think we need to get to a point where we get out of this sort of scientism that it's all just experiments and philosophy's a load of bollocks. You know, we need to see the value of philosophy, whether you take it in a spiritual direction or not. You know, for the experiment, there are questions you can't answer with an experiment, especially when it comes to consciousness. And I think what I talk about in my why book actually is how I think we've discovered that how you interpret the scientific data itself of consciousness is impacted by your philosophical assumptions. I think that's part of the reason I want to talk. Well, I've written some things for Scientific American about this. I think this is part of the reason we're still such a mess with the science of consciousness. Quantum mechanics is another one. The foundations of quantum mechanics were, I think, a phobia of philosophy has stopped progress. So I think we just need to get to that point where we take philosophy seriously again. And I think people will be less hung up with this, what is serious science or not? I mean, look, we should all, science is absolutely crucial and you should be respecting what the data, what the scientific experiments tell us. But we should also be taking seriously these philosophical questions. And I hope we'll get there at some point in the not too distant future.
I hope so as well. As a student of philosophy here, I've had it a couple times. What are you doing? There's no answers. I even remember one time I had somebody tell me, a math student, philosophy ended with logical positivism in the 20th century, which I thought was a pretty funny view to have nowadays. But thank you, Philip. Thank you so much. It's been really interesting. We'll be linking all your books down below, Galileo's Error, Why, and also your most recent article stating your conversion, which I think is a highly interesting read, and I would encourage everybody to go and read it. And yeah, I would like to ask if maybe you had any concluding thoughts for our listeners before we wrap up here.
Thanks very much, guys. Been a really, really, really enjoyable conversation and really great questions that are prompting me to work out these issues I'm still kind of thinking about. Concluding thoughts, I suppose. Well, yeah, I suppose to repeat, you know, I think there are certain different issues we've covered here, panpsychism, panentheism, Christianity. These are different things, distinguishable things. I suppose I've found a way of fitting them all together, but that's certainly not essential. And each of these things can be explored in different ways. But, you know, what I'm always about in all of these areas is breaking the dichotomies. You know, we get stuck in these dichotomies. You know, are you on Richard Dawkins' side or the Pope's? Are you a US capitalist or a Soviet communist? You know, are you a physicalist or a dualist? And we always ignore the vast range of options in between. So, you know, with panpsychism or panentheism or this mildly heretical form of Christianity, it's a view somewhere in the middle of at least how we standardly think about the two other options. And so, you know, I would encourage people to just see, you know, this different way of thinking about it, whether it changes your perspective. Not mean you might not end up agreeing with me, but it might make you think of some other views in a slightly different way, or at least it just keeps the conversation going. So yes, always good to break the dichotomies and explore some new views and different perspectives.
Well, thank you so much, Philip. It's really refreshing to hear somebody, especially in the analytic tradition in philosophy, be brave enough to actually come to a conclusion instead of saying, holding your hands up and going, hey, I'm not sure. So thank you, Philip.
I'll probably change my mind next week, you know, but anyway.
Well, that's what we're here for. So thank you very much, Philip. And this has been the Loaf Podcast, signing off.
Hey, guys. Thanks for watching that interview with Philip Goff. Make sure to leave a comment down below with your thoughts. Do you agree with panpsychism? Do you agree with Philip Goff's version of Christianity? Yeah, just leave a like, subscribe to keep supporting the channel, and click here for another video from the Loaf Podcast. Thanks for watching and see you next time.